KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman, and this is Weekday. Memorial Day has come and gone, but for soldiers, the aftermath of battle never fully disappears. We're going to hear more about that later this hour. Also, young Native Americans making films, the Superfly Film Project participants, Scream Productions on Saturday at SIFF. We're going to hear more about it. If you're a stargazer, this has been a very bad week for you in the Puget Sound region. Clouds have obscured the night skies, and that's particularly unfortunate because in other parts of the country this week, they've had a chance to see something called a triple planetary conjunction. Toby Smith is a lecturer in the University of Washington Astronomy Department, and he joins me today. Hello.
Good morning, Marcy.
It sounds like a tooth pull, a triple planetary conjunction.
Yes.
What is that exactly?
It's simply that the planets are grouping together in the sky just after sunset. One of the planets is going behind the sun. Two of them are emerging from behind the sun. And what's really interesting about this is not so much the conjunction. They happen all of the time. But it's really the players. One of the players, Mercury, is really hard to see. You almost never see it. And I've been looking at the skies for 40 years, and I've only seen it like a half a dozen times. But in this conjunction, just because it always sits close to the sun, it never gets very far away from the sun. And so unless you have something to draw your eye to it, you never see it. But with this conjunction, you have big, bright Venus and bright Jupiter.
Is it closer to Earth right now, or is it just the alignment?
Yeah, it's just the alignment.
They also call this the dance of the planets. That's clearly not an astronomical term.
No, it's just the fact that, you know, if you watch them night to night, they'll move relative to each other. You know, they'll make their little pirouettes around each other as they move by. So in that way, you know, it's just their natural, you know, motions around the sun.
You said planetary conjunctions happen relatively frequently. How about this triple planetary conjunction?
Yeah, I mean, they're always in the news. You know, once a year and a half, you know, it's just how the planets happen to line up.
I'm imagining, you know, three wise men at the birth of Jesus looking at comets or something. Does it do anything to the Earth's atmosphere? Or
no, it doesn't.
Like that?
Do it, no,
it's just,
I mean,
how it looks.
It's purely a visual thing. It's purely how it looks.
And they're not really any closer to each other.
No. It's just how we happen to be viewing them. They're lining up in the sky.
How far apart actually are these planets?
Jupiter is 5 times the distance from the sun from us. So between Jupiter, Venus, and Mercury, you know, you span 93 times 5. You know, you're spanning 450 million miles.
450 million miles.
Yeah.
And they look so close.
Yeah. They just happen to, you know, they're lining up because we just happen to be looking at them in a line.
You mentioned that you've been looking at skies for 40 years and you have rarely a chance to see Mercury. What does this allow astronomers to do when we have a conjunction with a planet that's usually so shy?
Mercury's a notoriously hard planet to observe. In fact, it's one of the few things Hubble Space Telescope can't observe.
Because it's too close to the sun.
And so,
wow,
you know, the fact that we see it in the skies for astronomers isn't really a big deal. But just the fact that, now you can see it. That's interesting. Like I said, it's a hard object to see and you don't notice it.
So the fact that it's so close to the sun, Hubble can't go near it, do we know less about Mercury than
Actually, we know quite a lot now. There is now a spacecraft around Mercury called MESSENGER, and we're getting our first views of Mercury since the 1970s. And so we're learning an awful lot about Mercury.
You know, I can see planets, I do like to gaze at the sky. We've been particularly unfortunate in this triple conjunction. In other parts of the country, it started, I believe, last week, the 24th,
yeah.
23rd or 24th. And they say it's going to end tomorrow night. I mean,
they're just close, really. I think they make their closest approach last night or tonight. But it'll actually be going on fine for the next couple of weeks. In fact, what did I write down? Like June 10th, a very thin crescent moon will be sitting next to them, too.
Wow.
So it'll look very pretty. So Mercury and Venus will be together in the sky for another couple of weeks.
Has it been clear since this conjunction started?
I haven't
started?
Noticed
you,
it being clear.
You haven't?
Yet.
So you haven't had a chance?
I have not seen it, no.
Where would one, should the skies clear, where would we go to get a good view?
Just watch sunset. Just watch the sun go down. It's going to follow the sun about a half hour after sunset. So just look where the sun went down.
So they're going to be in the west.
They'll be in the west, just north of west. Yeah.
And do we know which planet is which?
Venus will be the brightest one, Jupiter will be the second brightest one, and Mercury will be the dimmest one.
We're talking with Toby Smith of the University of Washington's Astronomy Department, and I'll look forward to seeing those. I often see the planets in the morning because I'm a morning person.
Mars is in the morning.
Yes. Mars is in the morning. Yeah. I know summer, should it be clear, there are other astronomical events that we can see. You know, you guys probably look at them with a more scientific eye, but I know August is a month for meteor showers.
Yes.
And these are the Leonids, correct?
Yes.
Is that their official name?
Yes, they are, yes.
What happens? Why do we see
meteor showers are simply when we are passing through the debris that's left over as a comet's come through the inner solar system. So as the Earth passes through that trail of debris, the particles enter the high Earth atmosphere and burn up. They're all very small particles. They all burn very high in the sky.
So it happens in August because of the way that the Earth is, not
because that's where our orbit intersects the former orbit of this comet.
And that happens every year?
Happens every year. Yeah, there's enough material that, you know, you run into it at the same point in Earth's orbit. There's another big meteor shower in November called the Leonids.
The Perseids.
Yeah, I never know.
Is this just something that we are fascinated with because it's cool to watch? Or does this give scientists any kind of information about our solar system?
The meteor showers do in some respects. Just it also reminds us that, you know, we do interact with our solar system. You know, the Earth is not an isolated place. Things fall on the Earth every single day. You know, the meteor strike that hits in Russia earlier this year, I mean,
that was very thrilling.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless it hit you, I suppose. You teach a class on the planets right now. You're about to run off to school. What do you tell your students when something like a triple-planetary conjunction comes their way?
Basically, just to look up. You know, it's a wonderful opportunity in that, you know, you don't need a telescope. You don't need any special equipment. You just need to be aware. You need to look up at the sky. And so, you know, it just keeps them aware. Oh, there's wonderful things to look at in the sky.
Is that how you started your interest in astronomy?
Essentially, that and landing on the moon.
You did not land.
No, I did not land. No, but watching the astronauts on the moon in kindergarten.
No, and that was a long time ago for students that you're teaching at,
yes,
at the UW. So how, you know, what sparks an interest when you look out on those students, if you're talking about planetary conjunctions or meteor showers? What hooks kids these days?
Rovers are good. The fact that we have presence on other worlds. It may not be us, but the fact that we, you know, have presence, the fact that you can see pictures, new pictures every day coming back from the surface of Mars are good. You know, the whole space exploration, we have satellites around Mercury. We have satellites around Saturn. We're learning about places that are very Earth-like around other worlds. And so it's really sort of our remote presence now.
Anything else that we could look forward to in our skies this summer?
Saturn's beautiful.
Saturn?
Yeah, Saturn is pretty high up in the sky after sunset. It's a beautiful object. It's one of the most amazing things to look at in a telescope. When you look at it, you can't believe you're seeing a planet with rings. It's one of the most...
You can see the rings?
You can see the rings if you're looking at a small telescope. It's absolutely beautiful. Here at UW, we have public nights every other Wednesday. I'm bad. I didn't realize when the next one's going to be. And Saturn's a beautiful target for it. It's one of the most... I love it every time I see it.
Public nights, where are they?
At the Theodore Jacobson Observatory at the north end of campus.
By the Burke Museum?
By the Burke, yeah, right across from the Burke Museum.
And do you have to register for these?
No, they're just sort of public drop-in things. They're every other Wednesday. You should check the website. Like I said, I'm very bad.
The University of Washington Department of Astronomy?
Yeah, the Department of Astronomy website. One of my colleagues, Anna Larson, runs a wonderful program there.
Wow, Saturn's rings.
Yeah,
I'm almost as excited about that as I am about the dance of the planets.
Yeah, no, it's a fabulous telescope object.
Okay, that's every other Wednesday at the observatory on the north end of the University of Washington campus. Find out more, and we'll find the link for it and post. I just looked up at the producers. They're nodding their heads. That'll be at our website, kuow.org/weekday. Toby Smith lectures in the University of Washington Department of Astronomy, and this quarter, they're talking about the planets. Thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you, Marcy.
This is Weekday.
It's 9:16.
Superfly Filmmaking is a program that pairs up adult mentors with kids who want to make movies. We'll learn more about the program and talk to some folks involved in it in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Hillside Student Community School, dedicated to teaching students grades 5 through 12 to think critically and creatively and to embrace their future with confidence. College prep, small classes in Bellevue. Currently accepting applications for grades 5 and 6. More at hillsidesc.org.
Cloudy and windy and 53 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says expect showers today with a high of 61. It's 9:17. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's been 10 years now since President George W. Bush stood on the deck of an aircraft carrier and declared mission accomplished. Of course, the mission wasn't accomplished. Later this hour, we're going to learn about the deep psychological impact that announcement had on the troops. That's about 15 minutes away.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. The Seattle International Film Festival's in full swing right now. If you've attended SIFF, you know it's a chance to see the work of master filmmakers. But you also get a chance to sample the efforts of a new generation, and sometimes that means a really young new generation. The Superfly Filmmaking Program's been part of SIFF since 2005 in partnership with the Native American Media Arts Group, Longhouse Media. Superfly partners with 50 young filmmakers, most of whom are Native American. They come from all over the country, and they are partnered with 20 adult mentors. The whole troop gets 36 hours. They make short films, and they're going to be shown as part of SIFF this year on Saturday at 4 o'clock at the Harvard Exit Theater. Joining us to talk more about the Superfly program and what's happening this year are adult mentor B.C. Campbell and Superfly participant Solomon Calvert-Adera. Thanks, both of you, for coming in. And Solomon, I'm going to ask you to pull that microphone even a little closer to you. But we'll start with you, B.C. Explain a little more for us, please, what the Superfly program is.
Well, it's like you said in the setup, it's basically 50 teens and youths from all over the country. They're mostly Native, and they come in and they have a very intensive 36-hour filmmaking experience, and they break down into small groups. I believe there's 5 groups, and those films get played at SIFF. And I think this year it's going to be Saturday, June 1st at the Harvard Exit at 4 p.m.
Yep.
And so it's quite an action-packed weekend.
How long have you been involved with the program?
So last year was my first year at the program. I was a music mentor, so I kind of produced all of the scores, and I had a scoring group. There's also a production group, an animation group, photography group. And so I led the music department.
And are you doing the same this year?
I'm doing the same this year, yeah.
Okay, well, that's BC. With us is Solomon Calvert-Adera, who at 12 is a veteran of this program. And I read, although this can't possibly be true, Solomon, that you've been doing this for 5 years.
Yes, so I was born into the film industry because my mom, she is a documentary filmmaker. So when I was about at the age of 7, I was watching my mom do these super flies. I thought it was really cool to see a whole bunch of youth come in from all around the country and make films. So about 3 years ago is my first year actually participating in Superfly. And this year is my first year participating in the animation group of Superfly.
How many times are you allowed to do it?
As many times as you want until reach the age of about 18.
Okay, so you've got a lot of years ahead of you.
Yeah, I do.
So the first year you did what exactly? What group were you in?
So I was just in one of the 5 film groups. In the first year, the theme was chased. So a writer brought 5 scripts in, and they each had sort of a different genre. So it was the same script, but adapted to a different genre, like horror, drama, sci-fi. And I believe I was in the horror group. And so that was a lot of fun. And we made a 5 to 10 minute video or film in 36 hours. And so, yes, again, the theme is chased.
Now, BC, 36 hours is pretty fast. SIFF has a fly filmmaking, which you just participated in that.
Yes.
Superfly is like a fifth the time, isn't it, of the fly filmmaking?
Yeah, luckily. So Tracy Rector and Lou Carson are the producers. Tracy is Solomon's mother, and they do a really good job of organizing it and making sure everyone has what they need. But it is pretty crazy and no one sleeps and it's awesome. I mean, imagine like the funnest, you know, summer camp that you could have. And that's really what it feels like. You know, everyone's running around. It's all hands on deck. But yeah, there's not much time to get it together.
Now, 36 hours. Solomon, walk me through it, because today is the day that you are number 50. There's 49 other teens and kids who are coming today, right?
Yes.
And so what happens? What? Tell me.
So the youth is 70% native, 30% non-native. And we all get together Thursday night, which is tonight, and have a big orientation, a big dinner. We are split into our five groups, start storyboarding, writing. We get our scripts. Tomorrow will be a just super labor-intensive crunch to get all of our shooting done, all the filming, just everything done. And then Friday night through Saturday morning, it's just editing all the way till 8 o'clock in the morning. Every group pulls off all-nighters.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't hear sleep or eat in there.
Yeah, so it's pretty crazy. It's fun, though.
And so till 8 in the morning on Saturday, and the screening's at 4 in the afternoon?
Correct, yeah.
Very
wow. Short turnover, yeah.
Yeah.
That seems not even humanly possible.
Well, last year I did not think it was possible because it was my first year. I'm like, there's no way this is going to happen. And sure enough, it happened. And at the screening, it was so fun. The films were great. They had this wonderful energy inside of them. Theater was sold out. It was a party.
Yeah.
We're talking with B.C. Campbell. That's the adult voice that you hear. He's a mentor for the Longhouse Media Superfly filmmaking program, which is part of SIFF this year. Also with us is old hand Solomon Calvert-Adara at the age of 12, already an experienced filmmaker. And B.C., I'm curious how you got involved in this Superfly in the first place.
Right. Well, I was my background is just being a songwriter and playing in bands locally,
right.
Being part of the music scene. And I had always loved film and wanted to be involved with film in some way. And so Lou asked me, he was one of the producers, to come in and just produce the scores and see what it's like. And doing Superfly, I really found what I wanted to do, which was compose for film. And so luckily, through the experience of it,
wow.
I was also able to meet some mentors who were two filmmakers who had come up from...
Mentors for you?
Mentors. Well, they were also mentors. Yeah, we were all...
Oh, you're peer
the
mentors. Adults, okay.
Peer mentors, right.
Okay.
These two filmmakers from Arizona that had come up, and they showed me a little sort of teaser of this feature-length documentary that they had been making for years called Water is Life. And so we later got connected, and I ended up scoring that film. And so it was kind of cool. Like, the first film I ever did was like a feature documentary. And I got together a group of phenomenal local musicians to record the soundtrack. I got this year's Stranger Genius Award winner, Lori Goldston, and Avon Kang, who plays with Beck, and Bill Frisell, and Lena Simon, who plays with local bands like Tompton and Paulins. And we all got together and just recorded the soundtrack. And it was so fun. And I love the experience. And so I've been working as a film composer ever since.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, so Solomon, I saw a link that Tracy, your mother, sent to me of a film called Cupcakes that you were acting in. So were you also part of the crew that produced that? And what is your goal in film?
Well, yes. So during Superfly, you can both act and produce or direct.
At the same time?
At the same time. It's totally up to you. It's up to your group to figure out how to do it. But for me, in my sort of film career, I really enjoy, I enjoy acting, but for me, I think that my challenge and what I really enjoy doing is sort of being behind the camera and just figuring out how to make the film possible, how to get the shots that you need. I think that's a good challenge.
Well, this year you're doing animation. So what do you know about that?
Well, I've done some animating before, stop motion at my house. And I've done a few animation classes. But I thought it'd just be a good change. There's one animation, Every Superfly. That's shown at the Harvard Exit screening on Saturday with the other films. But I just thought it would be a nice change of pace. Excuse me. I still get to meet all the people. Just a different experience.
The theme this year is curious, and I understand this is the first year that Superfly has done documentaries. This isn't going to be a feature film. So, well, I guess, BC, you now have a feature documentary under your belt. But how do you know how it would be approached differently than a straight-ahead feature film?
Well, I know in previous years they had different people write the scripts for each group, and those scripts were geared towards genre. So there was like a sci-fi, romantic comedy, and I think this year. And I think this year these are going to be sort of a collection of stories that are unique to the Suquamish community, and I'm not sure exactly how it's going to happen. Solomon, you probably know a little more.
Yeah. So. There's a lot of fun stories. This year there's like Sasquatch hunting, there's canoe racing, a day in the life of a teen on a reservation. And so there's a lot of fun stories that we're going to cover. And so what we do is we, or my mom and the producers of the whole camp, we give the information to connections that we can interview. And just sources to get information, but it's up to the groups to get there and to collect the information. So we just provide sources.
So as soon as one Superfly project ends for the year, it sounds like the folks at Longhouse start preparing for the next one.
Yeah, it's a lot of work goes into each Superfly, so it is sort of like a big cycle. But it's a relief to get through the Superfly every year. It's a big... something to look forward to every year, and it's just fun.
What do you do when you're not making movies? I don't get any sense that there's other time in your life.
Well, go to school. I go to a really good school on Mercer Island, FASPS. I learn French there, and so I've been learning French for 9 years.
Wait, okay, since you were three?
Yes, exactly. And so it's a really great school. I enjoy it, get a lot of scholarships. I do a native theater group every Sunday where we alternate every year in between a like a serious drama play about our history, and then we alternate with a comical sort of just a fun play that we write ourselves. And...
But you're imagining for yourself a film career, not a theater career.
I definitely enjoy film. I'm not really sure what I want to do when I grow up, but it's definitely fun to do.
BC, how typical is Solomon of the kids that will be participating in Superfly?
Oh, that's a good question. Man, there's such a wide array of people. Solomon is Solomon's great because he's so open-minded, and that's kind of the mentality that I encountered last year. Is people were just open to new experiences and maybe finding their voice, you know.
And the age range is up to 18?
I think so, 18, 19, yeah.
So last year, BC, how average age of the kids that you were working with?
So, yeah, the film department, I had two students. There were three of them. Two of them were like, I think they were like 9 or 10.
9 or 10 years old.
They were 9 or 10 years old, and one had played clarinet for, I think, 6 months, and the other kid played trumpet. And so it was a fun challenge to try to get them to write, you know, the soundtracks, you know, for all the films. So we all just worked together and got done.
Where does this all take place?
Well, Superfly is hosted by a different tribe each year. I know last year it was, I think, what, Urban Natives at the Daybreak Center. And this year it's going to be at the Suquamish.
On the reservation itself.
Yeah. Yes.
And so then does everybody, well, since you don't sleep, that's a stupid question, but I was going to say, is that where you would sleep and eat and everything happens there?
Yeah. There's so we get food donations by different companies. That's why it's a lot of work before Superfly even, you know, starts to come around. We need to find all the donations. And then we camp out usually. So last year at Daybreak Star, they provided a sleeping quarters inside of the center. But when we when it takes place on the reservations, we camp out in tents and everything happens outdoors. And
well, I'm going to hope that it stops raining, because although if you're working all the time, it won't really matter. But you'll be able to see the triple planetary conjunction
that's
that we
right.
just heard about. So While you're up in the middle of the night, you can run outside and look at the rings of Saturn or whatever. What are you most looking forward to in the next 36 hours? 48 hours, I guess.
Right.
Meeting new people. Just, I always have a really great time. Hope to see, you know, people coming back. That's always a really good sign if you see youth who apply again and come back. I'm just excited to have another Superfly under my belt, and it's just going to be as fun as every other year.
And what about you, BC?
I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, friends that I made last year. There's a lot of folks up from Arizona who are there. I'm very much looking forward to seeing them. I'm looking forward to meeting new people, too, and just seeing what kind of work people do. And, you know.
Is this 4 p.m. screening sold out already?
Oh, man.
It probably is, yeah. I would guess. Yeah. Is there any place that we can find the films, the product of Superfly, if we can't get into the Saturday screening?
That's a good question. I'm sure SIFF is probably hosting it on their site. I'm not sure when they're going to have that up.
Does Longhouse offer links to it as well?
Yeah, we... there's always more showings at SIFF. I'm not sure exactly when the times are or the dates.
So go to the SIFF.net website and we'll find out more information. I'd like to thank both of you. I think you should get naps in right now after you leave here. Solomon Calvert-Adera's a participant and born into filmmaking at the Superfly Film Program at 12 years old, already an accomplished filmmaker. B.C. Campbell is a Seattle-based film, do I call you a film composer now?
I think you can.
Okay. Yes. he's also being a mentor, past mentor, and continues this year at Longhouse Media's Superfly filmmaking program hosted by the Suquamish tribe this year. The 50 participants arrive in Seattle this afternoon, and the result of their 36-hour collaborations will screen as part of the Seattle International Film Festival this Saturday, June 1st, 4 o'clock at the Harvard Exit Theater, or check SIFF.net. In case that one sold out. Thanks both of you for coming in.
Thank you,
Marcy.
This is Weekday.
Nine 34, 54 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy, kind of windy out there. Forecast says showers likely today with a high of 61. Overnight, cloudy with a slim chance of showers and a low of 49. And tomorrow, Friday, looks like clouds in the morning, then mostly sunny in the afternoon, getting up to 66 degrees.
When documentary filmmaker Alex Gibney began working on his movie about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, he thought it was a David and Goliath story.
It was very much, sign me up for the Julian Assange crusade. But along the way, things happen.
I'm Ross Reynolds. Join me for a conversation with Alex Gibney about his documentary, We Steal Secrets.
That's today at noon, only on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Science Festival, presenting opening night with physicists Brian Green, Adam Frank, and Sean Carroll, and the West Coast premiere of Icarus at the Edge of Time, with music by Philip Glass, June 6th at the Paramount Theater. Details at seattlesciencefestival.org.
Next time on The World, families in Mexico call on their government to help find their loved ones. Over the past 6 years, thousands of people in Mexico have disappeared. Some have been abducted by criminals. Others have been detained by authorities and never seen again. Families say the government is not doing enough to find Mexico's disappeared. That's next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from ACT Theater, presenting Other Desert Cities. Tension and resentment unfold behind closed doors when the black sheep liberal daughter of conservative parents announces the publication of a tell-all memoir, May 31st through June 30th. Tickets at acttheater.org.
You've heard about 3D printing, right? Have you ever heard what one of those machines sounds like when it's doing the printing? It makes more noise than you might have thought. We're going to listen in on a 3D printer in about 20 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. When President Bush on May 1st, 2003 declared major combat operations over in Iraq, well, there were consequences for the troops there and for the length of the war. Captain Ed Hrivnak is a retired Air Force flight nurse. He has written about those times in a new book, Wounded, A Legacy of Operation Iraqi Freedom. He joins us in our studios. It's good to see you again.
Thanks for having me back, Steve.
Set the scene for me just a little bit. So where were you in March, and what were you doing in March of 2003?
We were part of the AIRVAC squadron that set up for the initial invasion force into Iraq. So our mission was tasked to bring the casualties out of Iraq back to Germany, and we also had a field hospital set up in Spain.
And in how did you operate in country in Iraq in those early days, or did you?
In the early days, Baghdad wasn't secure, so they actually had to shuttle the patients by helicopter or by a C-130 transport to Kuwaiti International Airport. We would pick the patients up there with a C-141 transport and fly them back to Germany.
And once you, and so when did you first start operating in Iraq itself?
It was probably about mid-June that we started having missions directly into Baghdad International Airport.
And what did you do? What was your responsibility, and where did you set up operations?
We had a flying hospital in the back of a transport plane. We could carry up to 100 casualties at one time. I think my personal largest patient load was 87 patients, split up between three nurses and four medics. And we would just land, hopefully, just long enough on the ground to pick up the patients. And then our work was really done in flight, taking care of them back to Germany.
So where were you when you heard that May 1st announcement?
I'll never forget it, because we had just dropped off a load of casualties in Spain to Fleet Hospital 8 out of Bremerton. And there were a bunch of us standing around the TV watching CNN when the announcement was made. And I remember the same joyous feeling as when I was in Desert Storm and they announced the war was over in Desert Storm. I think all of us standing there, we were jumping up and down, giving each other high fives. The speech, the tone of the speech really made us think the war was over. And at the time, it sure seemed like the war was over because all of our missions stopped. The war stopped for about 7 to 10 days. We didn't have any casualties. We didn't have any missions.
What happened? I mean, in the war itself, why did that happen?
I think a couple things happened. One, operationally, we secured all the cities that we wanted. So there was minimal movement from the ground forces. Second thing happened is I think the Iraqis really listened to that speech, and it gave them they saw that as an opportunity to start a guerrilla war. But it took them a few days or a week to get organized.
You wrote about something that I have not thought about personally until you wrote it. Long-reaching consequences for that speech. And one of the main ones was that troops thought the war was over. And you write about that yourself. I think, what was your phrase? I fell for the whole theatrical act.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, I very much wanted to work, and after about 10 days of sitting in Spain, not doing anything, I actually complained to our chief nurse that we needed to send half our squadron home because there was nothing for us to do. And they ended up doing that. They sent half of us home, and we started sending combat troops home. And we also noticed that we had patients who had injuries but didn't say anything because they knew there was a mission to get done. So about 10 days after that speech, we got inundated with all these non-combat casualties, guys who had injuries and were nursing their injuries and trying to get by. We also saw an increase of psych patients and pregnancies within a month of that speech.
Now, why was that happening? Well, the psych patients, first of all, why would that be occurring about a month after the speech?
There was an overwhelming sense over there that you could not let your coworkers, your comrades down. So I think people who were having physical and mental problems were doing their best to keep everything together. And after that speech was made, I think collectively the military let out a sigh of relief, let their guard down, And that started peeling back the pages for these problems to occur. And very quickly, we were overwhelmed with hundreds and hundreds of combat and non-combat casualties when we got to the end of May and especially into June and July.
So the pregnancies occurred because people were either willingly or, you know, we hear stories about violence in military sometimes, so unwillingly relieving tensions in some way?
Yes, I do believe so.
Not to excuse it, but that I mean, right. That's part of what was happening.
Right.
And then where were the combat injuries coming from?
It was real insidious at first, and I know we did not pick up on it at first. We would have, I guess what you call traditional ambushes, where a rocket-propelled grenade would be shot at a Humvee, or an assault rifle, an AK-47, would take a pot shot at a couple troops. We had these small civil affair teams that were embedded, like at Baghdad University, trying to, you know, establish water and food and services, and they were getting hit and ambushed. And it started to build into a crescendo of activity, and then we had what the first term I heard was a roadside bomb went off. And we saw these devastating injuries that eventually became IEDs, the improvised explosive device. Never had heard of such a thing before. It was probably about the end of June that we started hearing the term IED, and we started seeing casualties with absolute devastating injuries that I never experienced in the first Gulf War and had never seen in civilian trauma as an ER nurse. And that really caught us off guard, seeing multiple amputations, severe traumatic brain injuries.
You have said that this speech, you know, in the States it was mocked after a while, and they all look at George Bush and his flight jacket and then the big sign, everything. But you're saying that speech had real, long-lasting psychological impact on the soldiers.
Yes.
And service members.
I do believe that. I know it had an impact on me, and it had an impact on our troops because we saw it on the planes.
What was the impact on you?
Well, to be told the war is over, and I had mobilization orders as a reservist for 2 years. So I had a mental commitment or picture in my mind I was going to be gone for 2 years. And when that speech was made, it was the first time I thought about home. I thought actively about my wife, my family, my mom, and returning back to Washington State and becoming a civilian. Before that, I was very focused on the mission, very focused on accomplishing what our task was. And I think my peers and the other soldiers and airmen, we felt this, we were feeling the same way. And when that speech occurred, we let our guard down and we started thinking of home.
Captain Ed Hrivnak, retired Air Force flight nurse, has written Wounded, A Legacy of Operation Iraqi Freedom. We are now, 10 years out from the start of that chosen war. Are you seeing in your friends, or even when you're just moving about, are you seeing veterans like back in the population? I mean, as somebody who is one, do you see other people and go, oh, these guys, you recognize them?
They're hard to pick out unless you know what you're looking for. A combat veteran will never sit with his back to the door in a bar. They always have their head on a swivel. They may be wearing a little pin or device that shows that they served. They might have an old denim jacket with a patch on it. And as you can see with me, I still, even though I'm retired, I still keep my hair cut clean and I'm clean shaven.
You look very military, sir.
Yes. There are some habits in the military that are hard to break. So after serving, you're conditioned, and that's hard to break. It carries with you.
How about in terms of both you and the service members are affected by this war? We usually, when I say service members, combat veterans are affected by the war. Of course, usually we focus on those who are in combat, but you all support. You all were affected by this, and we often hear that this war was a war without the kind of lines that are drawn. So for you, I imagine it must have also been kind of all around you.
Absolutely. And that was one thing, is we really didn't know where the front lines were. And specifically for me as a nurse and the fellow doctors and medics I worked with, people have this, I guess, preconceived notion that somehow we all went through specialized training that prepared us for combat trauma. None of us had any special training for that. The devastating injuries and how, over the months of exposure, how that wore on our mental psyche, I wasn't prepared for it. The people on my crew weren't prepared for it. And we all felt guilty about it because we thought we were supposed to be prepared for it. And consequently, we didn't talk about it.
That's what I was going to ask you. You didn't...
And we never talked about it. We never talked about it. In Crewest, when we get back to Germany and we had the opportunity to get some German beer, we would drink and we would talk about the funny things that occurred on the mission, or maybe how the plane broke or how we ran out of medical supplies. But we never talked about the stress of caring for the combat casualties or the wounds that we saw. That never came up in conversation.
Have you had a chance? I mean, this book and this journal that you've written, other people have talked about it. It's been, what did you write? Two other books have kind of quoted this journal. There's been some theatrical productions, been a lot of stories about it. We've talked twice.
Right.
Have you met other older veterans, veterans of World War II or Korea or even Vietnam? And is the, if so, is that a similar approach, or is this war unique in the silence?
I don't think this war is unique in the silence at all. I think if we were able to go back and talk to a Roman legionnaire, it would be the same thing.
Same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I just recently spoke with a World War II vet who really did not talk to his family at all about the war. And because we were both veterans and had that bond, he told me things about World War II that he never told his children.
Should he have?
Yes. I think communicating, talking about what happened, writing about what happened is a way of healing. You cannot keep these things inside. You have to get them out, or else it'll eat you up.
How long have you worked on Wounded, a legacy of Operation Iraqi Freedom, Captain Ed Hrivnek? So I got all my work in there. How long have you worked on this?
It started out in 2003 as a piece of tape on my flight suit, and I would make little notes about the patients, how much morphine I gave them. And as I talked to them, it would expand to was ambushed or was severely burned. And I'd get back to Germany, and I would still have that tape on my leg. And I turned on the BBC, and the story on the BBC was very different from what was on the tape on my leg. And that's what started me for writing and saying, you know, the news is not catching what's really going on.
What was different? Was it just so far removed, or was it actually a different story we were being told?
It was so far removed because it was just numbers, strategy, and tactics. They'd talk about what city we occupied, how many troops were killed, but they never talked about the human experience of what it is to be wounded and the impact that makes on a human being. And that's what we were seeing every day.
And of course, Wounded is not just about that, but about the impact it has on all the people in the support positions, caring for these people.
Absolutely, absolutely. As I started to write and my work got published, I actually had a general officer, general rank. She called me and she said, I read your work. We're having a problem with our troops. I want you to do research for me. I want you to report to me direct, because when I go out and talk to people, they tell me everything's okay because I'm a general. I need you to go out there and talk to them one-on-one and report back what's really going on. And one of the most significant interviews I had was a young airman who was a clerk. She never saw a patient, but her job was to process the paperwork. And she was devastated by it. She felt like she had an overwhelming sense of guilt because she didn't feel like she was contributing enough. And I saw this and I heard this time and time again. But she saw the casualty reports and the injuries and the paperwork that she processed every day, and she was overwhelmed by it. And she carried that guilt home with her because she felt like she didn't contribute.
So has writing the book, was writing out these essays and journal entries first, and then writing the book, was it healing? Does it continue to be healing for you?
It's a combination. It's healing.
I don't mean healed.
Yeah, it's healing, But it also opens up some wounds that you really want to scab over and don't bring out again. There have been parts of the book that have opened up memories that I probably really didn't want to bring back, but they're there and I got to deal with them now.
So that might be better. You know, my father never talked about World War II. He was in combat in New Guinea, New Caledonia, the Philippines. Never talked about it. And the only thing I do know is that my mother often said, different person came back.
Right.
And I mean, I guess I'm asking, because do you think that veterans just need to pick up a pen or whatever outlet?
That's what I'm encouraging. And I'm actually working with the Great Books Foundation. They have a book coming out in August called Standing Down. And it's a collection of war stories to encourage veterans to write about their experiences as a healing process. And the Great Books Foundation will actually be doing workshops around the U.S. to help promote that for veterans.
You're part of a service family. Your wife is also in the service.
Yes, very proud of my wife. I retired as a captain. She's still in the Air Force Reserve as a lieutenant colonel. She works at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. And she did three tours of duty over a period of 3 years between 2003 and 2006. We saw very little of each other because of the deployments that both of us went on.
What's her job?
She is deputy chief nurse at the clinic at McChord Field for the reserve squadron there.
So she had similar experiences during those tours?
Yes. Prior to that, she was a flight nurse along with me. And she did a couple tours as a flight nurse, actively caring for patients. And then she was promoted to a staff officer position where she managed. It actually was her hardest assignment, where she managed coordinating bringing the wounded out and the dead. And when she took the job, she didn't realize that was part of her job description. And that was very difficult. It was an adjustment for her from doing that staff job when she came home.
How do you guys work together to help each other heal?
And you know that I talk about that in the book, and it was very hard for me to write it down because Jennifer and I had some real struggles when we came back reintegrating as husband and wife. And what encouraged me is when I went and did these interviews, I found that there were other military members going through the same thing, and I realized that the issues we had were not unique, that it's common. It's very common. It's universal in the military, the impact on a marriage or a relationship in a family. And I felt by writing it down, maybe it would help other families. It was a long road for Jennifer and I. I always say we were one deployment away from divorce.
Wow. But now you have two kids, and now you're going to have to talk to them about these issues. And they'll have a book to look at as well when they're older.
Right.
How will you talk to them as little kids? I guess you don't really have to tell them you're going away anyways, right?
We're not going away anymore. I'm retired, and she's in a staff position that keeps her home in the U.S. So we're very fortunate that we don't have to go overseas. We have friends that still serve that have to have that hard conversation with their children and say they're going to be gone for 4 months or a year, and we see the effect on their family, and it's devastating.
But you have no doubt about the value of your service or service in general. You would have them go in? Would you have them go in to service? Hard to ask about somebody when their kids are little.
It is hard to ask. I have my own opinions about the war in Iraq. I personally don't feel we were justified going in there. But as an officer carrying the rank and wearing the uniform, I do believe in our service, the armed forces, protecting our freedoms and our nation. It is an honorable profession. Less than 1% of our nation ever puts on the uniform. Very few people, very few Americans understand what it means to serve. I'm extremely proud of wearing the uniform, and I'm extremely proud of the men and women I served with. It's I work now as a firefighter, and the things I do as a firefighter and I see as a firefighter don't compare to the sacrifices I saw by some of my brothers and sisters in uniform.
You're still not sure about your kids?
Thought I was going to get off the hook on that.
That's something you're thinking about. It's clearly something you're thinking about.
Yes. I think letting your children enter into the military is probably one of the hardest things that a parent does because they know the risks. I only saw my father cry twice. And the one time is when he put me on the plane to send me to basic training.
He was a service member too?
Yes. Jennifer and I are both third generation military. And he had served during the Korean War, so he knew the risks involved. And I don't think I've internally answered that question. I'll have to wait and see when my kids are 18.
Ed Hrivnak is the author of Wounded, A Legacy of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Captain Ed Hrivnak, retired Air Force flight nurse. Well, I appreciate you talking to us.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day. Any guesses? Yeah, I'm going to tell
you. Shortwave radio?
Something like that. Not exactly. That sound comes to us from our listeners, Kirby and Neil. It's a Mendel Max 2 3D printer, and it's making a 3D butterfly out of that plastic used to make Legos. That was your second, right? Second guess?
What do they do, melt down the Legos?
I don't know. I don't know that. We should ask. Kirby and Neil, email us and let us know.
And send us a picture of the butterfly.
Send us a picture of that butterfly. Maybe we'll have it. We'll put it on our Facebook page. Wow. What interesting sounds are you listening to? We'd love for you to record 30 seconds of what you hear and send that wave to us along with the story behind it. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org. Include sound of the day in the subject line. We're going to be talking about brain science and how language acquisition and different kinds of language acquisition can indicate differences in brain structure between typically developing and autistic spectrum children with Patricia Kuhl. We're also going to hear about Kenya's Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission coming up in the next hour.
It's 9:59. We've got an update on the ricin-laced letters mailed to New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Every day, KUOW brings you stories based on honest and reliable reporting. We're committed to maintaining our standards in journalism, but we can't do it without you. Your support purchases and produces the programming you depend on. You may have received a special appeal in the mail. Please mail back your gift or make it online at kuow.org by June 30th. Thanks.
Mark Jenkins first climbed Mount Everest in the 1980s. When he returned last year, he was one of 150 people trying to get to the summit.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.